Hey, Rich.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay. Busy day so far.
Yeah.
But they all are, so that's all right. How about you?
Good. It's been kind of busy around here too, but today was a little better than the last few days, I'd say.
Okay. Yay. So we got the letter from Lori True,
Yeah.
and we just sent it out to everybody. And it does have some good things in it, and then it has some. So it's like you got to read a lot to get to a couple of things. But I don't know how we want to. It's just like anything else, I guess. That's a communication from folks to us.
And I should have sent it out earlier because I actually got it earlier. And so I kind of have some like information pieces that didn't get put into the packet materials that I sent out. Not that I had this in time to do that, but yeah, I just don't know how to incorporate into the discussion and make sure that people are aware. And when we come to talking about the agenda for the retreat, I have something to add, which is a long time ago, the commission asked about scheduling a time to do a tour of Aura, the new, hi Heidi,
Hi.
the new, I keep wanting to call it the Resource Center, the Aura Center. So they were available. They've been doing tours, and it is hard to schedule a tour for the commission in the sense that they can't, all the commissioners can't be in one place at one time unless they're already meeting and it's noticed. And so they have a block of time from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock on the day. So we're meeting from 11 to 2, and they said they can do a tour for us from 1 to 2 in the afternoon on the day that we're meeting, the retreat day. So I thought that might actually work out really well. We'll already be on that side of town. The meeting will have been noticed, and we'll all be together. Hi, Jackie.
I
have a question about that. Just, well, I guess we'll discuss it, but we have, I always thought we really need a significant time together to do this really critical planning. And if this comes, I mean, I don't want it to take away from that time.
Yeah.
And if it comes in the middle,
Well, it will come right at the end from 1 to 2. So at the very end of all of the other pieces. And I wondered if maybe it could be our sort of education piece. You know,
okay, well,
I've been
so let me
the
just say I hope we could do that retreat in 2 hours because sometimes didn't we do it before in three or something?
Yeah, but we always do have a guest speaker component, and that guest speaker takes, you know, about an hour of presentation and question and answer time. So some of the time, and we usually have them at the very beginning. The other thing is, I might also be able to arrange a tour of the Rogue Retreat.
Pilot shelter.
Yes. The shelter. I actually have been just calling it the Beast Main Shelter.
Yeah, that's good.
It works. It's, you know,
Yeah.
descriptive and doesn't use the word campground.
Yeah.
So we could potentially have both of those, which might be kind of fun for people to see or interesting.
And you're talking a physical visit, or are you talking about a virtual?
Physical.
Physical.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll talk about that with our agenda retreat stuff because I think we don't really have a set agenda for that at this time. Hi, Joy. Hi, Linda. Hi, Liz, and hi, Brandon. Everybody joined at once. I hope nobody's in the waiting room or in the, let me look. I think that's right. Yep, we're good. So I think I should tell you, Rich, that I heard from both Anita and from Chris that they may not be able to join us, or they may be joining us late. Just a heads up about that.
I had to go get a pen. And now I have it, but we've certainly got a quorum, so we're good to go on that. Hey, Linda.
Hi.
And Echo.
Hi.
And Joy, everybody. There's a little noise in my background. Does everybody hear it, or am I okay?
So far.
I can hear it.
Very faint on my end.
Okay.
Very faint. Wait till my dog Ellis starts whining. I'll have to do the same thing. Jeez.
Linda's dog will be joining us soon, I have no doubt.
No doubt. Yeah.
I am actually not at home on purpose. They are just so loud right now. I can't be home with them. They're just terrible.
I was on a Zoom call earlier today and Buddy went crazy. Just, I don't know if it was like a package getting delivered or, you know, something that really was unacceptable in his world. But, oh my God, I had to like just get off the call. I can't do this.
Oh, we have a dog that may join us, but I don't know where she is right now.
But. Yay.
I can see mine, but I gave him CBD treats, so he'd be quiet.
Yeah. Now, there's a dog.
Ella right there.
I get to drug him into silence.
And what a good group of people we have here. Just so excellent. So. Well, it is 4:00 and we have a quorum. So I'm going to welcome everyone, staff, commission members, and everyone to the November meeting of the Housing and Human Services Commission. If you've been looking at the agenda, again, we just have an amazing discussions that are going to be happening during this, and some important, really important decisions to be making. So the first thing that I always forget is the approval of the minutes. So people have seen them, and we could have a discussion and a motion to accept or amend the minutes. Jackie.
I read through both sets of minutes and they looked very good to me. And there was a minor correction I sent to Liz, very minor. So if there's anything else, I'm happy to make a motion.
Well, it sounds like, unless Heidi, are you ready to, did you have anything you wanted to add? No? Okay.
I actually didn't see the minutes. Huh? I saw the note from Linda that said that you were going to try to get them to us, but I didn't see a follow-up. So I'll just have to.
I sent them out to the commission 2 days ago.
Oh, okay. I missed it somehow.
Yeah, I tried to save it on the side of my screen so I could look at them now, but I don't. But I read them and I thought they were okay. So. Jackie, why don't you go ahead and make a motion?
Okay. I move to approve both sets of minutes that were in our packet from the last 2 months of meetings of Housing and Human Services.
Does anybody want to Second that.
Second.
Echo seconded it. Any discussion? All in favor of approving the minutes, do it by hand. Is there anybody that opposes it or wants to abstain? I don't see any, so it passed. Oh, Heidi.
I'll abstain since I haven't seen.
Heidi is going to abstain. Okay, thank you.
And I'll email them again to you, Heidi. Make sure you got them.
Okay, so the next thing on our agenda is the public forum. Do we have no folks for the public forum? The next thing on the agenda is the housing production strategy overview. And then we have Brandon eagerly awaiting. And here comes his screen. So go ahead, Brandon.
Hi, thank you for having me today. I see a couple of unfamiliar faces as new commissioners. So to introduce myself, my name is Brandon Goldman. I'm a senior planner with the Department of Community Development and have worked with this commission and the Planning Commission and Council most recently on the adoption of the 2021-2041 Housing Capacity Analysis, which was undertaking to look at the housing needs within the community, looking at the demographics of the community, and ultimately looking at the buildable lands inventory, how much land we have, do we have the capacity to accommodate needed housing? And as part of that analysis, it did find that we had the capacity to accommodate the housing based on land. But as you all know, having the type of housing that's necessary to accommodate the population of the community that needs housing at different price points is a different issue. So part of that analysis was in anticipation of doing a housing production strategy. And to just reiterate, and I know many of you are familiar with this, but a housing production strategy really identifies specific actions that the city can take, and namely take within an 8-year period that is our activities that are within the city's control that would help facilitate the development of the housing that's needed for the community. It is a requirement for communities of our size that was passed by the state at House Bill 2003 in 2019 that all communities between 10,000 and 25,000 do a housing production strategy and to do one within 1 year of doing a housing needs analysis. So the timing is perfect. We did apply to the State Department of Land Conservation and Development for a technical assistance grant to carry out this work. And we're awarded that. Essentially, the state will be, has selected Echo Northwest, the same organization that helped us with the housing capacity analysis, to work with us on development of the housing production strategy. And that work is going to kick off here in January. I think I'm getting ahead of my little short presentation. But so what that will do is, as I mentioned, there'll be a timeline that gets associated with when individual actions will be complete. Newly added to the housing production strategy that I haven't spoken with the Housing Commission about previously is that we wanted to look at doing a anti-displacement analysis, looking at marginalized populations and how they might be affected by policies or investments or subsidies that the city provides for housing. And so as part of this proposal, we wrote that into the scope of work for the state to consider, and they're agreeable to fund that activity to do a spatial analysis that identifies areas within the community that are specifically vulnerable to change and specifically areas within the city that have concentrations of low-income households where vulnerable populations would be displaced from housing. And so essentially what this means is if the city were to take a, I'll just use like a wingspread mobile home, it actually accommodates quite a bit of low housing within the community. if the city were looking at strategies to increase the development of multifamily housing and applied those to that property or to that zone, what impact would that have on those low-income households? Would it have a unintended consequence of facilitating the closure of a mobile home park and the development of higher-end multifamily housing? You know, so as that's clearly not the objective, we want to analyze those things as part of this strategy as well, so that each production strategy or activity that's forwarded for consideration contains really an assessment of what those impacts would be. So that is a new aspect. So a housing production strategy, and again, the longstanding commissioners are going to be familiar with this because we did a lot of the legwork in the development of the housing capacity analysis. Namely, we looked at a variety of different activities that the city has already done, a variety of strategies that other communities have implemented to address needed housing and affordable housing. And as such, this chart just really shows that it runs the gamut from producing materials that are informational in nature. Those maybe have very little impact in actually creating needed housing, whereas land acquisition and disposition would have a significant impact in terms of creating opportunities to develop needed housing. And in between there is all the decision points that will be made when the housing production strategies are really looked at as and prioritized. Which ones are within the city's purview to do early in the process, which are things that are done continually throughout the 8-year period, and which things would be you know, essentially larger issues that could be done systematically, one every couple of years. Obviously, we wouldn't be in a position to identify all strategies and implement them all within 1 year. That's really just not a something that we would have staffing or commission or planning commission or city council availability to implement all changes at once. So we're going to begin the work on this. Are you guys able to see my presentation?
The only thing that I can see is one slide that says City of Ashland Housing Production Strategy with an image of a partially framed wooden structure and text.
Okay, so it hasn't been going along for you. So let me stop and start again because I'm noticing a red line around it. And I'm wondering, did that help? Are you guys able to see?
I see nothing. Oh, yeah. Yes. I do see a slide now.
Okay. Well, you know, one benefit of doing a very text-heavy slides is I essentially read to you much of what was on the preceding slide. But this is that visual that shows the range of activities that the city would be considering. And right. I would point the newest commissioners to look at the recently adopted housing capacity analysis, because in the back of that, Appendix A, it includes dozens of potential strategies that have already been discussed as part of the housing needs analysis. And so that gives us a head start on the housing production strategy. My expectation is all of those strategies will be coming forward, but we may identify additional strategies as well. And to go back one further slide, this is just how a housing production strategy is used. Yes, Commissioner Fay.
I would love it if I could get a hard copy of your presentation. Is that a most possibility? Definitely. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
And so we're going to be kicking off on January the housing production strategy. We've been working this last month with the Echo Northwest and the state to refine the scope of work and get a final award from the state for that. Echo Northwest would begin work on January 2022. And as you can see, it is essentially a year-long process to develop a complete plan. And at the end of that plan, it would be adopted as a technical support document to the comprehensive plan. And so then that gives it, from a municipal jurisdiction side, the benefit of being a guiding document for how the city moves forward.
Gotcha.
The Housing Commission involvement, and I wanted to highlight this because there's a couple of asks that I'll likely to be making of you after we do kick off the project. The first is part of the scope of work is to utilize an ad hoc advisory committee similar to what was done in the housing capacity analysis. And Commissioner Fields and Commissioner Parker were representatives from the Housing and Human Services Commission as part of that process. Again, we'll be looking for two members from this commission, two members from the Planning Commission, likely a city councilor, as well as members of the development community, both for-profit, nonprofit, also looking for a representative from the newly formed Social Justice and Equity Commission. I'm forgetting the name of it right now, but to participate on that group, as well as the Climate and Energy Action Plan Commission. So as really a group, those individuals would work as liaisons to their individual commissions, as well as bringing back ideas and evaluation as part of the strategies. We're also going to be looking to incorporate into the housing production strategy really stories that address actual individuals that have experienced housing burden within the community, whether that's unmet housing needs, not being able to find any place to live, whether it's somebody that is currently housed but rent burdened and struggling month to month, and incorporate those stories into the plan so that ideally we can link those with what strategies will help address that unmet need. And so this is something that I spoke with Linda Reed about, and she said the housing commissioners were already working on some of these activities through other organizations. And so something I'll be reaching back out to you to see if there are volunteers on the commission that would help in compiling those stories, possibly interviewing those individuals, and really creating that anthology of stories that goes hand in hand with why we need to do what it is that is being proposed in the production strategy. And with any long-range planning project or housing assessment, public participation is key. So we plan on doing some hosted events, and they may be virtual in the age of COVID. They may be in person. We'll have to wait and see. But nonetheless, I think participation by the Housing Commission is always of value there. And then we get to the, once we have a draft document, the review and refinement of strategies, the review and recommendation for changes to the draft report, and ultimately a public hearing before this body to make a formal recommendation to the city council for approval or approval with amendments. And with that, it would then go to the planning commission for review and approval, and then on to the city council for approval ultimately. So that was my quick presentation. I see that this is a 25-minute agenda item. When I spoke with Linda previously, I thought it was a 15-minute agenda. So I wanted to do a 5-minute presentation for Q&A afterwards. But we have a little bit more time. So with that, entertain any questions you may have.
Well, I bet we can fill the time with questions. And so I'm seeing some hands popping up, and I do think there's some significant discussion. Joy, you were first. Go ahead.
I would like to know whether you're taking into consideration zoning for tiny homes.
Well, yes. I mean, I think if you're asking of specific items, the answer at this point in time will be yes to 100% of them, because the process of going through the housing production strategy is taking any ideas and seeing whether they can be incorporated and what their output would be. So there is in the housing needs analysis a list of items that have previously gone through, and in that items looking at creative alternatives to housing and creative housing types. And I would say tiny homes definitely fall in that category. So that would be one consideration.
That's really terrific to hear. I think non-conventional housing is really necessary. What I've heard is that there are many challenges in terms of zoning and what's allowed and what's not. So,
yeah, I can address some of that.
Yeah, sure.
And it depends on a definition of tiny home. So currently, if you want to build a 110 square foot house, you can do so. There isn't any limitation on house size in the city of Asheville. We've seen units as small as 150 square feet built, but they're put on a foundation.
Right.
And so tiny homes, the vernacular is often meant to be recreational vehicles on trailers that are built outside of the recreational vehicle industry, home build. And those tiny homes, one of the biggest hurdles they have is building code, that under our standards, in order to be considered a permanent dwelling, they have to have been met building codes along the way. And a lot of people build tiny homes on trailers explicitly to avoid having to get any building permits or have any review process. So when somebody rolls in with a tiny home that has had no review and inspection, the building department can't sign off on it being considered a permanent dwelling. So those kind of issues are something that can be flushed out, you know, but I think some of them go beyond local zoning amendments that would have to be building code changes or really a change of practice of the people that are building tiny homes to do so in a way that meets a standard. Yes. So that people aren't in a home with one exit, no window that's big right. enough to crawl out of in case of a fire, those kind of things.
Right. Gotcha. So,
yeah, it's definitely, you know, right now an RV, if I call them RVs, can be located in, you know, like multifamily home development parks and those kind of things, which are allowable in all multifamily zones in the city. But you can't necessarily park an RV on your property and live in it full time. So that's the issue that you're bringing up.
I would be interested in taking a look at, because I'm very new here, new to the game. So I haven't had the luxury of reviewing what you've done in the past, but I would be really interested to have an opportunity to take a look at those kinds of things.
Yeah, most definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll get you the, you know, I don't know that there's any kind of white paper on tiny homes though. So we'll to have that as a discussion. But we can definitely give you the housing capacity analysis and some of the prior work that's been done. And, you know, I'm eminently reachable. If you have questions when you're reading through that document, give me a call. I'm happy to talk with you one-on-one and flush those things out.
Thank you.
Questions, people? Jesus, because I got a whole bunch. And I don't want to do this whole thing, right?
You'll get us going, Rich. Go ahead.
Well, let me just start with the notion that this is probably the most significant time and piece that we have as a Housing and Human Service Commission, because we have certain strategies now, and they are nice but inadequate to do what we need. And so this is the time when our commission, the planning commission, the city council, and every citizen of Asheville or non-citizen can weigh in on what we need. And there are a lot of options. When they present the options that they've come up with so far, we can choose from about 50. We're not going to get 50, but what we get is going to be absolutely critical to what we do. So I know that there are groups out there now that are ready to step in and give their view of what should be done. So I guess my first question would be, can we A, speed it up, and B, is there going to be a time that we can let people know when they get to come to a hearing, not a hearing, but a forum that they get to give their strategies?
So the first step in the housing production strategy is to develop a public outreach plan. So through that public outreach plan, we'd be looking at when can we accommodate those opportunities? Where would we create a virtual open house? And at what point would it be best plugged in so people could be familiar with the issues and make suggestions. As far as speeding up the year-long process, I would say no.
Well, it's almost a year and a half or something, isn't it?
Well, it's a year to have a completed plan. the public process for adoption of that plan has to go through the Planning Commission and the City Council first and second reading. So you're looking at 4 months for adoption after you have a plan in hand that's ready to go, just to meet the required noticing periods for each of those public hearings. So we're looking to have it completed by the end of 2022, but it would then be, as you say, going before public bodies for adoption at hearings in 2023.
Right. So that's like a year and a half.
I'll say a year and a quarter.
I'll be impatient for everybody.
See.
But I guess another question is, in the formulation of stories from impacted people, and I think that's kind of the traditional way that groups think of it. But now in Oregon, we're moving beyond tradition a lot. And one of the ways that they do that is that we're setting up in many of the spaces, they call them spaces now that I see, that people who are impacted have real decision-making or real policy participation beyond just, here's my story, I lived in my house and da 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 da. And so can we incorporate that kind of role for people with people with lived experiences, for people who have been impacted by the crushing gentrification of our town?
Yeah, most definitely. I think that explicitly when we talk about public engagement, it's intended to reach people that are most impacted and have them participate in that public participation. I mean, we do have an advisory group that is comprised of people that can attend 5 meetings and have direct knowledge about housing development. But if it isn't informed by people that are experiencing rent burden or homelessness or, inability to purchase, even for a moderate income household, I think those voices added into it through that public engagement process are vital. So the scope of work actually articulates it quite a bit better than I could. I think once the scope of work is approved by the state, I would then be in a position to share it with the commission so you can see what the state, Echo Northwest, with significant feedback from the city of Ashland, for instance, adding the anti-displacement strategy component shows. So we'll be able to give you that before the kickoff date in January to show you there is some forward movement. A lot of things happen on the back end, but I think you're totally right in terms of it's not just those stories. I think those stories are part of the presentation materials for the broader proposal, but they're not necessarily the basis for what strategies get selected. They help inform it, but that public engagement with those populations and reaching out to organizations that also work with those populations regularly is also helpful. So we'll try and hit it on all fronts and make sure that no voice is left off.
Linda Rapon.
So if I understand your presentation, Brandon, you will want a couple of people from our commission to serve on this interdepartmental committee. And then you would like us to host one of the forums.
Or maybe I don't know that you'd be hosting the forum. You could. I think that Echo Northwest, a consultant team, would help in that regard. When I say a hosted forum, it's not just an online resource that people can go read on their own. We want to have an engaged open house or some way actually to engage the public. In past practices, having commissioners and volunteers, if we do end up doing I'm trying to think of like a World Cafe format open house where people are at individual tables, it's always useful to have individuals that are not voicing opinions, but taking information in at each of those tables. So those kind of, if we can do a in-person event, having commissioners at those tables to hear from the participants directly and help facilitate individual tables is very useful. If it is an online engagement, we may be able to do breakout rooms in a similar capacity and make sure that appointed or elected representatives are in each of those breakout rooms to, again, hear what the community has to say. So again, it's not fleshed out what it would be. We'll
echo Jackie.
I'm trying to get an idea of what the scope of work, how that impacts this commission in terms of what our work year is. We'll have people on a subcommittee. We'll be getting reports back from them. Do you see us being involved sort of on an ongoing basis through the year with Echo Northwest? Or?
Yeah. So we have, in addition to the, I think there is scheduled, tentatively scheduled, 4 meetings before the Housing and Human Services Commission. You know, so the strategy review, the plan review, the final public hearings, and earlier in the process, kind of once we get a public engagement plan, bringing that back to the commission for review and consideration. So those are at your formal meetings. There is going to be 4 or 5 ad hoc meetings, and that's those 2 participants that would go to those and be able to provide comment. To the degree that things come up at those meetings that you want to bring back to your full commission meeting, it might be a, you know, update item on your regular agenda that the participants in the ad hoc committee provide an update. So that would be the lion's share of the commission's meeting time that is spent on this. And I know you spend probably 3 times that amount of time reading the material and thinking about the object, the items before coming back to those meetings. So yeah, it's a heavy lift, but it's a big project. Probably our largest long range project that the city will do this year. And so it'll be quite a bit of time with this commission and the planning commission.
It's very exciting. I look forward to doing it. I just was trying to kind of wrap my head around what we were taking on.
Okay, Echo, and then Jackie, did you have something too? So just go Echo, Jackie.
Okay. Speaking of outreach plans, something that I picked up on listening to the city council meeting the other night, I'm not sure they've actually looked at the housing capacity analysis report at this point, and I might be wrong, but I think we also have to sort of work on council outreach as well. I have the sense that there might be people on the council who are so distracted about all the other things on their plate, which are considerable, that they may end up asking the housing production strategy process to reinvent some wheels that are already in that capacity analysis. So there's kind of a, like, nudging members of the council to read that document occasionally, like actually read it, not just skim it. And then as far as public engagement, I'd like to see us take some of those engagement opportunities outdoors, since we're looking at probably a timeline where the weather will be better. So that means, you know, taking it out to the park, taking it down to the SOU campus where there are students that are rent burdened and facing houselessness, taking it to student family housing at SOU, taking it down to Clay Street, taking to shopping carts, parking lot, wherever, but actually doing outreach that goes to people rather than expecting people to come to us.
Yes.
And I think we also have to be careful, number 3, of having World Cafe or those kinds of participatory decision-making events, having those dominated by the usual suspects, meaning the typical nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations that always show up because we need them. But that tends to be kind of an interesting sort of elite, cliquey kind of event, and I'm part of the clique, granted, but I'm very aware that it is a clique and that we need to break out of that. So those are my 3 points.
Well, those are good points and excellent suggestions. I would note that the housing capacity analysis, all members of the council now were on the council when it was approved. So if they'd read their packet, they would have had the opportunity to read it when they voted on it, which I'm sure that they did. The other thing that I would note is that when we did the virtual outreach, we did get 547 respondents to the housing capacity analysis, and in a town of 20,000, that is a good turnout. Mm-hmm. So as much as in-person contacts are highly missed, I think virtual does reach people when they're sitting at home on their couch and able to participate at 2 a.m. So we want to include that in some capacity.
Okay. It only reaches the people who have couches.
Okay, so I'm going to move to Jackie and then Joy, and then I think it will probably move to the next agenda item. But Jackie?
Thank you. One of the concerns I see in looking over the years at what's been going on in Ashland in terms of housing, first of all, there's so many good things that are going on. Rich and I have talked about, Columbia Care and the units going in there with 24/7 counseling, and Snowberry. We see such an incredible increase of units. The shelters, how many spaces we're developing now with, the Pallet community, with Aura, with now the emergency weather shelter that we're looking at. So the concern I have is the gap that I see between the shelter community and needing transitional housing. Transitional housing, because next you have some affordable housing that we're starting to put in. And of course we need more affordable housing than we have, but we've made some real success at both ends on the continuum there. But in the transitional housing part, it's like a desert out there to try to figure out, people who have, the Section 8, vouchers, they can't get into transitional housing even in the Rogue Valley. I mean, it is a desperate situation for these people. And yep. So I guess my question, if there is one there, Brandon, is transitional housing specifically a housing production strategy that the plan is addressing?
No, because we haven't developed the plan yet. So I think it's one that can be identified. When we did the housing capacity analysis, it really looks at housing for different income ranges. And so there is a gap in housing that's available for people that are making, let's say, $30,000 or less a year. And those might be individuals that would be moving into transitional housing if it, that very low income. So it does address it in that sense. It doesn't label it as transitional housing. It just is housing is housing. It also doesn't address shelter requirements as emergency shelter need, because again, that is not a permanent housing type, although there clearly is a need for that. And a 10-year homeless plan would identify a need for that shelter housing. I do think that, to the degree that transitional housing has to be subsidized, when we look at priorities in a plan in terms of where city subsidy goes to support needed housing, supporting needed housing for low-income households that need transitional housing could be articulated as a strategy in the plan.
Excellent. And I just have one other point I want to mention in the plan that I hope everyone gets a chance to look at the charts, that the impact charts that are in the housing production plan that show. You had one of your slides, actually, Brandon, that was showing what has the most impact after Echo Northwest did their analysis. So they have all these brilliant people, analyzing what could make the most impact in Ashland, given, 20 different components. And So, using the urban growth boundary, land banking, for instance, was one that was a big impact. I'm sort of assuming that when the developers get together in these groups with housing and planning and whatever, that they're going to focus, I would think, on those big impact strategies. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, I think it is. A lot of the low hanging fruit in terms of removal of regulatory barriers and things, the city over the last decade has done quite a bit. You know, not to say that it succeeded in addressing the magnitude of the problem. But, you know, I know one of the strategies was allow ARUs and duplexes in every zone. Pretty simple strategy, a little harder to implement, but now that's allowed outright by code. So nobody needs to go through a planning action to achieve that any longer. So it's those kind of things that we have been doing and I think we'll continue to do. But those bigger issues that have a big impact, you know, formation of a like a housing, I'm forgetting the housing, not a housing trust fund. We have one, but funding the housing trust fund would be a bigger impact issue. And actually forming a, you know, a nonprofit organization that really land banks and
land trust.
A land trust that creates would be a bigger issue as well. So yeah. Those kind of things I think can have significant impacts and would be some of those more magnitude issues included in the plan, if so desired by all the people that participate and the decision makers. I don't want to preempt that effort. But I do think that having a housing trust that is set up that can do that kind of work would help with those larger issues like land dedication, you know, as well as development. So, and I think just to clarify to the new commissioners, what Jackie is referencing with the existing charts, they're in the housing capacity analysis.
Thank you.
So that is the document that we'll be sharing with you. That shows those charts and weighs the impact of what's a high, medium, or low impact. You know, we probably don't want to focus a lot of energy on things that don't have a positive outcome, even though they are listed statewide and what some other communities might have done. So,
thank you.
Okay, so is there another question? Joy, quickly.
What are your parameters for defining low income?
I would probably defer to Linda Reed. So we have low, moderate income, but there is, you know, 30% area median income and below. And I don't remember the current numbers, but I'm assuming median income family of four is 52,000. So that would be 100% median income. So 30% of that would be a low income household. Do you know that number, Linda?
No, I never know those numbers off the top of my head.
Well, that would be very low.
That would be extremely low. A low
they call it very 60%. Low, and then there's low.
So 60% of $50,000 is probably $30,000, right? So if somebody making $30,000 or less would be 60% AMI for a family of four. That's
and I can certainly, I'm happy to send out the current income guidelines. And generally what happens is, yeah, they get broken down into percentages of what is considered median income for our area based on census data. And so 30% is considered extremely low, and then very low is 50, and then 80 is moderate. And so generally in the city, when we use those terms, we are looking at those percentages and they are consistent with the HUD income guidelines, which are also on our website.
Okay. I just wanted to say thank you for answering the questions to the best of your ability. And also just to remind you that our community has an extraordinary number of low income and very low income people.
Right.
And I would encourage you to remember that the privilege of having a computer to do Zoom conference work or having a house or a couch to sit on, you know, I mean, many people take it for granted, but I see the other side of that coin frequently. So I would just ask that you kind of keep that in mind.
We will.
Thanks.
Echo quickly. We're
very quickly. If, Joy or Kathy, if you want a study buddy to help you walk through that 60 plus page housing capacity analysis document, I'll volunteer to be a study buddy for you. Heidi and I were on the committee that drafted it. So it's pretty good, actually. And it answers a lot of the questions you've got about what the official definitions are of like income thresholds and all that kind of good detail. So it's like, it's the place to start for all of us.
Linda, Reed.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention when Brandon was talking about the shared stories of lived experience and housing cost burden, or the meeting before this, or maybe October or September, you all had discussed hosting an event to address housing cost burden. And so I felt like those two things might dovetail nicely together, and that with that event would be a way that we could sort of elicit some of that feedback and get real real stories of the barriers that people face in trying to find rental units that are in their means, and then how we could use those stories to help inform this process.
So as you heard, we're not going to be choosing who gets to be on the work group tonight, but I think that everyone ought to think whether that would be a place that they could volunteer. Oh. And it's really, really critical. And then I would just say, they've given us two, but that doesn't mean that others can't stay in touch with what's going on with that that effort. And so it will be important. So everybody think about that. And then we're going to move to the next agenda item, which is a update on the council debrief, which we did Tuesday, which we had a wonderful report from Linda Reed, which you all probably, am I doing this okay, have read. And Linda Rapon had kindly said she was going to be able to do it. And her technology went out. And so Linda Reed and I kind of went in and gave the report. And I think it was significant that the report was great, but the questions that they asked, and Linda Rapon, you might respond on this point, but I thought there was one theme I thought was the interest in balancing the need for general housing affordability with the need for focusing on shelter availability. And Linda, you want to add anything?
I thought that the council was much more engaged in the content of what we do than I had experienced in previous years. I felt like they really are on board. And, you know, some of that is we've got our own Gina on the council now. And, you know, it is the critical issue that people are talking about. But it was very good to see that level of interest in what we're doing. And how cool is it that if I have a problem getting online, that Rich Linda can slide in there and do a magnificent presentation on with no advance warning? That was awesome. And they were amazing.
Echo.
So I listened to it. And I think Steffi Seffinger got a little confused by what Linda Reed reported about how well the city is doing in terms of removing obstacles to building affordable housing versus the actual existence of affordable housing. So she kind of got her wires crossed. And then the mayor kind of jumped in to uncross those wires, because Steffi seemed to kind of have the notion that, well, we're doing great with improving the availability of affordable housing. And that's not what Linda Reed meant, but it's what Steffi kind of heard. And then the mayor kind of stepped in to go, well, asked a follow-up question. So I thought at that point, you never know what specific nerdy details you're going to need when you do these things. But I was sitting there going, dang, you know, I wish we'd had some of those numbers from the rent burden information that we've got, you know, the numbers to throw around, because counselors love to see numbers. And then a couple of the data points from the housing capacity analysis about our 800-ish shortfall in affordable housing in the next 10 years. So I wish we had known that we needed to have that. I also think they were expecting a PowerPoint. They seemed disappointed that there wasn't a PowerPoint. Was that just me? Did you pick up on that, the two of you? Other, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so, sort of pleased that there wasn't, but I don't know. I think Linda prepared a really good summary. You just have to listen to it. And
I think they needed a visual to go along with the auditory.
Right, right.
That's good input for the next time we present. Thank
yeah.
you.
And I would agree with Echo. I think it's very helpful to have a visual and to have at least one slide that has some statistics on it that they can hang their hat on a little bit. So, yeah.
Well, I would just add that in the interim, I got an email from a counselor who is interested in giving us another charge. And I don't know if it went to you, Linda Reed, or not, but it did. And so I do think that we are kind of in the center of what council people are looking for. And I think we did mention in the report to them that we were working on what our next agenda item is, which is the heating and cooling policies. And so I think they're starting to say, oh, well, we can give stuff to the Housing Commission to do, which may be okay. So we are, I think, a center of one of the of part of the things that are going on for the whole city. So, Linda Reed, did you?
Oh, I just was going to say that I have seen other commissions' presentations to the council. And most of the time they don't have a PowerPoint, right. Except for like the Public Arts Commission seems to always have one. But then, you know, their charge is art. So they have nice pictures to put up. And so, yeah, I was a little surprised because I was like, nope, we don't have that. And we've never had a PowerPoint. And I was a little surprised by some of the questions because they were so much broader in scope and seemed to be more about the housing program. And Echo, I would agree that some of the information could have been found in the housing capacity analysis. And so there was sort of a linking back to, yes, the housing need is shown in the housing capacity analysis. And I wanted to give a shout out to Rich to say that he did a really good job of bringing it back to the housing production strategies as to sort of, you know, those are the ways that we'll get more tools to address the housing needs that we clearly have, even though we have a lot of really great housing tools on our books. It just hasn't been enough to keep pace with that need.
Well, given that, I guess our next agenda item has gives us like 40 to 45 minutes, I think, to discuss the cooling and heating extreme weather policies that the work group has been developing. And there was a memo that I hope everybody had a chance to read that Linda put together that I think is a really good starting point for that discussion. And the first half of the discussion, but I think it doesn't have to be a half, but the first part of the discussion is a report from the work group. And so there, and the stakeholder meetings in particular, in which there were two. And so both Echo and Joy, you all want to just start sharing a little bit, 5 minutes about the things?
I think it might be helpful if Linda Reed could share screen on those notes, the summary notes from those two sessions, so that everybody can kind of just skim those with their eyeballs for a minute.
I can. I don't have those open on the screen right now, so it'll take me just a minute.
Yeah, that's okay. So I took notes. Joy facilitated the first meeting, and then things fell apart a little bit on the second. So I ended up sort of, there was a little crisis happening at Joy's place that night, which I hope is better now, fingers crossed. Anyway, so I was facilitating and taking notes at that second event too, but I think what I typed up was pretty accurate. So those two summaries of those meetings reflect, are kind of organized in terms of the topics that we think council wants to see addressed in the policy. So it's topics like who should be the activator for declaring an emergency shelter, either heating, cooling, or smoke. You know, what should the communication process be? How do we get collaboration and cooperation between multiple organizations, social service, churches, et cetera, whenever those shelters are stood up? Linda, have you been able to find that yet? It was in the packet. The notes were in the packet for today. So people may have seen it in the packet. Maybe. Anyway, so I'll pull it out of my head. Because I don't have the packet open in front of me right now either. Let's see. I was not prepared to do this. I'm catching this on the fly. There were some recurring themes between the two meetings. Probably the major one, and Heidi helped me with this because you know more than anybody about the institutional memory here, but the need to have our public buildings back. So that's Pioneer Hall, Community Center, The Grove. And that was something that people brought up in both sessions. There was also something in both sessions about the city needs to do more because the churches in particular are running short of capacity to do what needs to be done. Volunteers are too old and getting older. We're dying off, frankly. And those sort of mainstream Protestant social justice churches have small congregations. And so there's just more need than the current conventional, traditional, typical groups will be able to provide going forward. There are also, you know, just there's ongoing year-round demands for those, for support from those organizations. Whether it's ORA or the Presbyterian Church or the Methodist Church or what Rogue Retreat will do on East Main, that's like year-round need for food and shelter. This is like on top of that.
Yeah.
And so that's a challenge. Linda, have you found that yet? It's in the packet for today. It's in the PDF.
No, I found it and I have it open. And when I go to share screen, I have so many things that it isn't showing it to me. And so I'm trying to clear my screen. I have the PowerPoint presentation that's coming up later. I have the thing that you emailed. I had a letter that was provided to us later. So I have a few
things,
and honestly, I'm just not seeing it. So I'm just trying to find it in here. So
I made a handout for those meetings, actually, since Linda just mentioned it.
Would you rather? I have that one.
We could put that one up for the moment. Okay.
Heidi has a question.
Heidi's got like more wisdom.
I'd just like to interject that I don't think it's necessary to put that up on the screen because I think we've all seen it. And, you know, what I'm more interested in is the takeaway from all that and how we can incorporate that into action. Because I feel like from my perspective, having done this for years, it's not necessarily easier to have city buildings just because of all the hoops you have to jump through to access the city buildings, like background checks and things like that, just unforeseen consequences of utilizing the city's buildings. So I actually found it much easier to use churches because we didn't have to have all those prerequisites in place. But what is important is to be able to have a designated place that a lot of people know where it is so that when you call the shelter, the emergency shelter, it, you don't have to scramble to find places. So from my perspective, those are some of the bigger issues. The temperatures are really variable. I thought that memo from
Lori True.
Lori, yeah, was really helpful. I didn't entirely agree with all of it, but I think because I don't think we've solved all the issues around unhoused people and the need for emergency shelter, I don't think it's solved by all the various types of shelters we currently have. I still think there is a need. And I think there is an overlooked population of elderly people in our community who don't have the resources to cool when it's excessively hot. And at the meeting I was at on the 9th, the senior center coordinator mentioned that during really hot days, they have a lot of seniors at the senior center.
But Linda, if you scroll down in that document you've got up right now to the list of vulnerable populations, it's the bottom page of the handout. Yeah, so it's we tend to get really focused on unhoused persons for obvious and good reasons, but it is broader than that.
Okay, Joy, quickly. Yep.
Oh, that was what I was also going to echo. running the underground shelter, doing it in the summertime when there were heat issues and smoke issues. There are absolutely people that I'm helping who come in that are seniors and they don't have the ability to afford having an air conditioner, or they don't. You know, a lot of those creature comforts aren't available to an older population as well. So not only are we talking about people who are, quote, homeless, but we're also talking about seniors, mentally ill people. You know, our whole community has.
I think as a result of what we do tonight, today, is going to be a recommendation to the city that is going to give them some specific direction in terms of what we would like to see. So that's our goal. And Linda Reed has made it a little bit more easy by giving us this memo, which has, 6 points in it. And then we have this the threshold discussion is probably the most key part of that. But I do want to add that we had a really large turnout of stakeholders. I guess we missed the hospitals, but we had a large group of people that came and participated. And that gives us some, and as we've seen, some people are writing into us and they're going to be writing into the city. It gives us some credibility about doing this really well. And that means getting in everybody's point of view and coming up with a program that doesn't represent the past, but represents what we think ought to be going forward. So
Linda, you can probably take down the share screen.
I don't know. That's,
you still like it there? Okay, I don't know.
Okay, Jackie, and then
I went to the second meeting, which I think probably was very different from the first meeting because it was a very mm-hmm. small meeting and you were there too, Rich. So it was a lot of the Housing and Human Services people, but it was very helpful. Lori True was there from Church of Christ. And then she wrote this nice memo. And one of the things that I'm really struck by is there needs to be some kind of structure, in my opinion. And I'm like Heidi, not as long as Heidi in this whole a continuum of figuring out the shelter issues. But I was on a group, on a committee that involved the city council. It involved Aura, because that was the local organization. It involved several stakeholders in the community. several city, including the city administrator, assistant city administrator, all trying to figure out what do we do? You know, same problem. It's the same problem coming back again. And what came out of that for me is that there needs to be some kind of structure where there's one person who is calling, basically calling a meeting that is occurring on a monthly basis or a weekly basis, depending on what we have to do to get started here, but to figure this out, because it's going to take getting not just these public meetings. I think it's going to take more than that. I mean, certainly we could decide to recommend to the city that, okay, we think you should use a city building. And this is these are the city buildings we think you should use. Well, that makes it simpler, because you don't then have to say, okay, well, Church of Christ is willing to be on Tuesdays and Presbyterian is willing to be on Wednesdays, and then trying to coordinate that, the whole thing. The key to me is you've got to have some kind. Heidi was the coordinator, so she truly understands what I'm talking about. There needs to be some city, I think, coordinator, which is Linda Reed right now. Well, that involves time and staffing that Linda, I'm sure, doesn't have. And so that's where I'm having some concerns about who is the coordinator, and between the city and maybe another person who probably should be paid.
Did you read the memo? Because the memo sets it out very directly.
Yes.
I mean, at the top of the thing is going to be the city manager. And then there's a team that's built within that that's going to activate. We're going to pre-approve all the shelters ahead of time, so we don't have to do that. So some of those pieces are there, and the collaboration needs to be led by the city, as you pointed out, but that's in the memo.
No, I know that. It's just actually what's in the memo and what you can actually do because of people, power and resources, money. That's an issue. So we can recommend and see. My concern too is I'm hoping the council doesn't say, okay, let's take the marijuana money that we would normally give to Housing and Human Services to do some of these things. You know, yeah, that to me is not a good idea.
No.
So go ahead.
Let me just say, if everybody's read the memo, are there questions? Or to me, the only thing that needs to be filled out a little bit more is the threshold discussion, because all we have is A, Medford, and B, then a bunch of charts. And do we want to just give them Medford and a bunch of charts?
Oh.
No, I don't think so. So that means that we need today to come up with, I think, the rest of the memo, we can fine tune, but it's all right. The part about the threshold, I don't know that we have any kind of agreement on it, but I'd like to hear what people think about the threshold options that we give to the city, Joy.
I think it's appropriate. The model number one that we've been referencing was the 35 degrees. For winter, it was 35 degrees or below, 45 if there were precipitation or other mitigating factors. The heat was, I think, 98, and an air quality index of unhealthy for sensitive groups and above. There's a little wiggle room, but I can tell you that I would really like to see the 35 degrees as the, I don't know, what do you call it? The point where we would call a shelter.
Well, I was struck that Lori True's letter was based on an assumption that I found problematic personally, which was that ORA and the Pallet Community on East Main would be picking up, would somehow be part of this emergency climate weather sheltering on top of what they already will be doing year round, 24/7. She mentioned that in the second stakeholder meeting. Jackie was there for that one too. And I think that's not true. I think that's not correct. But we need numbers to support that. And then her argument in the letter, if you looked at that today that we just got, was I think kind of the argument is that the city can't promise or say that it's going to provide a level of service that it does not actually have the capacity to meet. And I could see other people raising that as an issue as well. So her position, and this was what I heard in the second meeting where she attended, was that if you set those thresholds at model number one, which is Joy's model, it's also a model that comes from public health authorities, by the way. If you set the numbers at those levels, the city manager might be trying to activate shelters that we don't have the capacity to actually provide.
Yet.
And the other best practice for these kinds of shelters, from some of the research that we've been working on, is that you really need to have two nights in a row for overnight sheltering. Daytime sheltering has different sort of parameters to it. But when you get into overnight housing, which could be because of heat, would definitely be because of smoke. When you get into overnight sheltering, the needs for wraparound services and on-site staffing is considerably greater.
Okay. Heidi, go ahead.
So all this has been set up before in the past. When I was doing shelters, we had 30 to 50 people a night. And I think the number of people that are currently on the streets unhoused, the number is smaller than that now. Joy would know the numbers. How many, on average, how many people do you have a night?
I'm also instituting, I've incorporated COVID safe practices. And so I'm limiting people. They need to be 6 feet apart and whatnot. So that brings me down to 15 for sure. Mm-hmm. If it's absolutely dreadful outside, I can make room, but it's not ideal.
Yeah.
So you can count. And I might add 10 minutes. I open the doors at 5. I'm at the shelter now. Within 10 minutes of opening the door, we will be full.
You will be full. Yeah. So the reason we kept adding more and more nights was because it was so difficult to call emergency shelters. It was much easier to have planned shelters 7 nights a week and know who was going to staff them and where they were going to be than to call emergency shelters. The city manager called an emergency shelter, but he would call me, and then I had to coordinate getting all the pieces together, including how do you get people out on the street by the freeway to the shelter when it's really cold or smoky and they're walking miles. So it's a huge deal to really do this effectively. And it's much easier to have a set place for every day of the week and set volunteers. But I don't know. I mean, I know what it takes to do that. It's a tremendous amount of work. And you have to have dedicated people and volunteers to make it work, because it's too expensive to pay people to do all that work.
In those old times, Heidi, we didn't have the ORA, which has, what have they got in there, 50, 60 people? Now.
Yeah, we'll be up to 70.
We should, 70.
We'll be, yeah, 70.
Right, and you have 56 they say, at the Rogue Retreat Center, which they say can be up next week. Mm-hmm. And then you've got 15 at Joy's. You add that up, it's like 150 people that we didn't have before. And that's going to be there every night. They don't, it's not an emergency situation. But that doesn't mean that there still aren't people, either unhoused people or other people, who need that in the winter. And then we have to also consider the summer. So those are two things that we need to give parameters, give the city council a choice. They've chosen 20 degrees.
And that's not okay.
That is not okay. There's nobody in the city that says that that's okay, but now we've got to give them something new. And that's what our job is today.
Well, I've given you my thought.
I know what Joy is.
So if you start at a lower temperature, that means there are going to be more days of shelter throughout the year. And that means you have to set up a different system than totally relying on volunteers and location. So the reason Lori was suggesting lower temperatures is because of all the different shelter options there are right now, but it doesn't totally solve the issue.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know, because neither ORA or anybody from Rogue Retreat were at either of these stakeholder meetings.
Oh no, Cass Sinclair.
Oh, that's right. She was at the first one. That's true.
And she's the executive. Yeah.
Okay. So what I don't think we addressed at that first meeting, because it didn't come up really until the second meeting, was whether or not ORA specifically would be able to add on to their stable population at the Super 8. Would they be able to?
That's not been a part of the discussion to this point. And that may be one of the reasons why it's important to bring together that, you know, a Rogue Retreat representative and our representative, a couple of city, get them together to start to work out more details. Because I don't, Linda Reed, you tell me, I don't think we're there with the details yet.
I would probably just not weigh in I would say, if you don't feel like you have enough details, and maybe others feel that way, that would definitely change.
Linda Rapond, add us some wisdom here.
I just have more questions. So has anybody looked at how many days in the last couple of years the temperature was 35 or 32 mm-hmm. or 30?
Well, we've got the heat numbers. I don't know mm-hmm. that we have the cold numbers.
Kelly Madding did do that. Kelly Madding did look at those numbers. And what you just have to realize, of course, it's going to vary, and we don't know from year to year. But if you make it a higher temperature, instead of not 20 but 30, that you're going to open the shelter, now you have more days, of course. So you can have... Right. If it's 10 days, I think we had 11 days at 20, and Kelly, she raised it depending on precipitation. So it was often warmer than that. But if we had done 30, then you were looking at doubling the number of days.
And so what I have done is not, I didn't break it down by temperature, because temperature isn't the only thing, because it also could be weather. So the what I did was I sort of looked back at the past and provided how many times the shelter was called. This most been the most recent year because of inclement weather, meaning a temperature which was a low threshold, which wasn't always 20. It was more like, oh, it's going to be cold, can we have a shelter? And then other inclement things. And then, you know, part of the chart that I provided included the years when ORA ran the like regular winter shelter, which was not because of inclement weather, right? So that kind of skewed that number. And then I looked back at the much older years when it really was just an inclement weather shelter under the very old, you know, Ruth model. And those ended up being, I think, on average, 11 to 12 days a year.
Okay. Linda Rapond.
So I know this is not ideal, but I am concerned that we actually forward something to the council tonight, at least for the cold weather shelter, because they're not going to meet until December. And, you know, otherwise we're going to be into cold weather at any point before this would become operational. So I would suggest that maybe we focus on the cold weather part and take the warm weather issues to the council later on in the year. Because I think we have to come up with a threshold and parameters for that part, I think, tonight, because it's going to get cold and there's steps beyond us where it has to be activated.
Linda Reed.
So the one thing I would say is that Linda Rapond at the second meeting had a great suggestion that I think everyone was really open to, which is to put in the caveat in the language around the thresholds that essentially says the thresholds are a baseline and that the city administrator or the city manager, whomever we appoint as the person who identifies when a shelter will be called, will always have the discretion to call it on, you know, their own feeling about whether this is a needed event. And then I think in the first meeting, I may have pointed out that on the matrices of all the other communities, that they often used sort of a catch-all phrase like in any inclement weather or any condition deemed necessary. So I think we can broaden the language to sort of expand that out if you feel that that would meet your needs better.
I see a lot of head nodding with that, but let me just say, if we threw in 30 degrees instead of 20 degrees, plus this flexibility that and it would end up being, by the memo, it becomes almost like a committee that works with the city manager to have flexibility to call it another time. Does that feel like where everybody could end up at? Echo.
People are still going to get hypothermia and die at 35 degrees. They're certainly going to get hypothermia and die at 20. And if they're, and neither ORA or the pallet shelter on East Main, I'm not calling it an urban campground on purpose. Neither of those are exactly low barrier. There are strings attached to being housed in either of those places, at least some strings. So what we end up with are people who are the hardest to serve, who don't have transportation or don't have, you know, have awareness of those other facilities. We're still letting people die in the cold. And so the city manager, there's an irresolvable and unresolvable conflict for me that I cannot get around between the temperature at which you need to call a shelter in order to prevent death or other kinds of long-term injury versus the capacity of this community to actually deliver on services. So I don't know how to resolve that.
Well, that's what we've got to do.
And it makes me very uncomfortable.
Well, there we are.
That's
so. That's what policies have to do. So, Jackie and Heidi.
Okay, so I'm just sort of taking the ideas that we're all talking about, and ask Linda Reed: is it possible that we could say something like, "We recommend 30 degrees"? And the discretion of the city manager in making the decision on when to call the shelter.
30 degrees based on what?
Well, based on statistics about when people die.
Which is much warmer than 30 degrees.
I understand that. I'm saying I think 30 degrees is a reasonable, from my perspective, it's awful when you think about it. But given that we're talking probably about 15 to 20 people, it sounds like, given Joy Faith's numbers, that if we called 30 and could get them into a shelter. My concern is, will we have a shelter to put them in? Because I don't know that the Fifth Street Church is going to be able to continue all winter long.
Right. And do you mean 30 degrees air temperature or 30 degrees wind chill?
Okay, hold on. Heidi, go ahead.
So I think we should say 35 degrees. I think we should say what it really is, both for heat and for cold. And then say, Joy already is running an emergency shelter. And that if the city were able to, so before when it was 20, the city contracted with Aura to provide emergency shelter. They paid the people to go out and put up notices and say, this is where the shelter is, et cetera. And then they paid hosts for overnight. We didn't go for days at a time. At a certain time in the morning, 8 in the morning, people had to leave. But there were other facilities in town where people could go to get warm throughout the day. The library was one. The library was a space that we had a number of emergency shelters there. Anyway, since there's already a person in town who's conducting an emergency shelter of sorts, perhaps the city could bring the stakeholders together who are providing services and see what could be worked out. That would include Joy, that would include Aura and Rogue Retreat. And the city manager came up with a plan when I said, I can't do it anymore. It's gotten too difficult to find places and people on the spur of the moment. So the city manager helped us design a system that worked. And it's not up to us to fudge the numbers and say things that aren't true about what's a safe temperature. We know what, we basically know what the numbers are. Well, and we need to say those. And then have the city needs to figure out a plan for how to manage all that.
All of that is in the memo. So I'm not worried about, well, we should be worried, but the plan would be that the city manager with a team and then the stakeholders being part of that are going to be the ongoing decision-making about this part. We're going to have pre-approved places where to go. But I think the political question is, what is, give us something about the temperature that gives us a guideline on what we're doing. And 35 has been out there. And I guess my question is that 35 degrees, is that related to anything? I mean,
yes.
What is it related to? What can it be?
Let's see if I can find it.
We can say 32, you know, basically 30, freezing plus wind chill plus wet,
right,
makes it more dangerous. Correct. And everybody knows that.
Yes. Yep. And adding that discretion, I think 32 might be a good number to use with discretion with the, right, the rest of the weather.
Right. So let me just see a general feeling. I've heard 32 with the kind of notion of wind chill put into it a little bit, but that as the moving it from 20 to 32. Linda Reed.
I would just say, and then you could add language and any additional factor, and that would cover any additional factor. So it could be wind, could be rain, or even, you know, what was it, like freezing fog? I mean, all those things.
Yes, sleet, snow. Yeah.
According to the National Coalition for the Homeless, this is in that handout, life-threatening hypothermia can set in between 32 degrees and 50 degrees, depending upon those additional factors. So 32 is the absolute minimum.
Right.
And so, there's actually a reference to support that number.
So if everybody's seen the memo, which I'm pretty clear in my mind. I think it's a good set of recommendations with the notion of 32 and the part that we just discussed. Does that seem like something that we would be ready to send to the commission, to the council at this point? And Linda, would you be able to bring that together from this discussion?
Could we just go over each point of what it says and see if there's an agreement or not?
She had it up there for a while, and I don't have it. I have it on my computer, but Linda, can you put it up again? No?
While she's looking, can I just say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say I really appreciate Heidi describing how the stakeholders could come together in a problem-solving group under the city manager, and including Joy Fate and what she's doing and Rogue Retreat and Aura. I think that makes very good sense about how to work out the details.
I'm trying to find the memo.
Which are you talking about? The one from which memo are you talking about?
I thought I was reading a memo from Linda Reed that said there were 6 points in it, and it had a discussion on every point, and I read them all and was ready to adopt them with the exception of the, it wasn't filled out for the thing that we just discussed for the,
was it in our packet? Oh, it was.
Okay. Let me get to the packet.
It wasn't in your packet. It was emailed out separately because we had to have another subcommittee meeting in order to get that put together. And I did have it open. And now, did you see, I got the one that I was trying to open before, and now I can't find it. So I am going to find it. Continue about your business while I make faces at you, because I'm actually...
Okay, I think I found it. Can I share screen?
I think you can.
Okay, I'm going to try sharing screen and see what happens. It says it's 12. Okay, I have to look, make sure I remember the name on it. It's this one. Okay, so I've got it on share screen.
There it is. Yeah.
Okay. So it's dated today. And so point one, the policy will set parameters. And what we've just been talking about is specifics. Number two, the policy will identify a coordinator. City manager most commonly recommended, but not only that. Policy should outline a plan.
Well, it does have the, can I just say, it does have this this decision-making activator team. That's what I liked.
Yeah, that's good.
Is that under number two?
Under number three.
Number three.
Echo came up with that title.
Decision-making activator team.
Yes.
The DMAT. We'll call it the DMAT. Ooh, we got an acronym. The DMAT.
And I think Lori's letter and Joy in our subcommittee meeting both referenced the use of a phone tree-like system that would identify sort of who comes next, and that eventually at some point there would be a Nixel alert. And so one of those people in that phone tree would be whoever could do the Nixel alert, and then there would also be a sort of social media piece. So that person, whomever that will be, or who that is currently, would also be in that DMAT team.
Oh God, an acronym has been born.
You know, maybe it would be something that I would volunteer to be on the activator.
Right, absolutely.
It'd be that hard because everybody definitely has access to the same weather forecast. And, you know, I'm in the thick of it as it is. So I'm happy to do that piece.
And maybe Heidi. I don't want to volunteer you for anything. They haven't adopted anything yet, just because you've got all this experience, which I certainly don't. Yeah.
Okay.
And I put the council's
the assignment
motion at the beginning, just for your guys' reference to see what they really are asking of us. And I think you don't have to do specifics with regard to who is in the activator team, but just to let them know that we want an activator team with someone who probably may be the city manager, but then the people underneath could be identified and we could fill out some of those roles if we want.
Right. And it's somebody with the appropriate kind of type of authority. So an elected official or an appointed administrator. You know, certainly with Linda Reed's support, but not putting it all on Linda.
So as we're kind of moving quickly along, so we get everything done, number three is about a plan. And then four is that it should coordinate groups of people inside and outside to work together on implementation. Okay. That's the grouping coming together.
So on number three, where it says CERT volunteer lists, I worked with CERT to try to get them to volunteer to serve at them. We had one, I did two trainings at CERT with over 30, 40 people there every time. I had one person from there volunteer, and the CERT coordinator never was available when emergency shelters were called. So that's not a good plan to do CERT, even though they're trained to respond to emergencies. It's not a useful thing to put in there because it didn't work.
I think one of the things that we heard from Medford was that they have training for volunteers. And so I think that's kind of what we, whether it's CERTs or anybody else, we would be working ahead of time to give people training about, and that seems to have worked well in Medford. So I think that we could take CERTs in or out, but I think we still need the same coordination.
CERTs in limbo right now, kind of still. Is that true?
I don't think we need to worry about CERTs. Just if it isn't working, we'll go to the next group, I think.
I did reach out, by the way, to SOU's military science program and talked to Major Timmons, who's in charge of the cadets, because these are people who have signed up to do National Guard duty, for example, who are supposed to be engaged in these kinds of activities. And he said, yeah, you know, when you guys get something together that, you know, that you could include students at these students on a call, it would be good for them. And, you know, so we'll see if any of this comes together. But I had a nice chat with him.
So in number four, I love it says that the agreement of all these groups is the desire to center the voices of people with lived experience. That's a great term. We should all be using it. And I think
you gave us that term.
Well, okay.
So, no wonder.
But it's anyway. And what about point number five? Oh, yes. This I really like is that it will debrief after each event so that it's a learning community that is, if we have a problem, we're immediately able to identify it and work towards a better solution for the next one. So,
well, and I was going to say that with regard to CERT or any other, you know, potential volunteer group, that it could be identified as, you know, doing outreach or explore the potential. We could use those sorts of phrases, but it doesn't have to be something that is like a definite thing. But just to put it out there, maybe for the city council to consider that, you know, we would be looking at other pools of volunteers to come into them, some of which may be, you know, under the control of the city. And I wondered, Heidi, if you felt like the volunteers that you were working with were not willing to spend the night in a shelter, but that might come to a shelter activated during the day.
Well, certainly there are some people in the community who would prefer to. We had one windstorm and we activated a shelter at Pioneer Hall during the day. And there were a lot of people that a lot of elderly people who volunteered to be there to, we rotated people through for two or three hour shifts during that time. Spending the night is a big deal, and especially because some of the guests are not easy to deal with, because there's a lot of mental health issues. A number of the people that are already sheltered in more assisted living type spaces were easier to deal with. So the emergency shelters were always more challenging. So my hat's off to Joy for taking that on, because I know how hard it is. But it requires some training and knowledge of how to interface with difficult behaviors. And so that's all part of it also.
I agree in that it's important for any person who's volunteering to have a good handle on de-escalation skills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everybody has their own issues and they come to the table, and I like to meet them where they're at, regardless of whatever it is. But I would say a volunteer having de-escalation training would be a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Anna D'Amato did that for us a number of times. She's very good. I think she's at SOU still, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, she is. She's actually the director of the counseling services for SOU students now. She's still around. Somebody else to add to our list.
So let me suggest a way forward here at this point, is that can we ask Alinda Reed, and if anybody wants to volunteer to work with her, to adapt this memo to our recommendations to the city council, and we could do one of two things. We could pre-approve that tonight and let that happen, or we can ask that it come back as an email to us, but we can't really make email decisions. So I would ask
you
that
can. So let me just say this, Rich. If you wanted to, I could adapt this, send it out to you all. If you have comments or changes that you want to make, you could all email me individually only. I can make those changes, email them out to the group, and then we can approve it over email that way. But you can't email each other, because that would be like having a meeting offline. But you can email me. So, I mean, it feels, I guess, if you guys took like another like maybe 5 minutes, Rich, just to go over the parts that you want to keep, or if there are parts that you are uncomfortable with or feel like there's not enough, we could flag those. And then I can, or give me some direction just to make sure that what I do send out to you is, you know, substantially what you're wanting, because it is hard to do a lot of wordsmithing through that method, but a little bit would be okay.
So I can't move it up or down. How many pages? Can we get this down to less than 2 pages and then include parts that we got that Echo sent that have the different color-coded things about the heat and cold.
You want me
we
to?
We haven't even seen those, right?
No. Do you want me to add that in? Do you want me to? I have that on my screen so that we could call it up. And, you know, a lot of this is just sort of verbiage that's in here for your benefit to help explain. Right. So some of that can go away and it will make sense.
Right. That's what I was just thinking, if we get it down to one and no more than two, and then you have this kind of additional attachment of those pieces, it looks like we've really had the discussion about the heat and cold in a thoughtful way.
So with regard, I mean, did you settle on 32 with any additional factors? You know what other term I liked? In whenever there is a whatever National Weather Service alert is
right. Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes those are issued for, you know,
yeah.
Do you guys want to add that language in as well?
I thought That's we did good. That.
Okay.
Yeah, they do severe, sort of severe weather advisories that include things like temperature. And some cities actually use just those numbers to trigger shelters. Or the Universal Thermal Index. That one's fun.
Okay, Joy, go.
I would like to maybe make a point. I agree that we don't really have all of our eggs in a basket, right? So I thought someone mentioned earlier focusing on the winter piece because it's winter and, you know, time is kind of critical. And I know that we want to get something to the council, but my fear is that it's not as comprehensive as perhaps we would like it to be. So maybe just focusing on the cold weather portion with, you know, other factors to come. But I would like for us to be really confident with what we're submitting.
I feel a little bit differently. I agree with Rich that we could have Linda work on this document, send it out to us and have us look at it. And then give feedback to her. And if we felt that it didn't cover everything we want it to, you know, we could then move to that point. But if there's a way we can get this to the council now in a good form, I think we should try.
I say that I think what's going to happen when it gets to council, and maybe we don't have Gina here, but I think they will listen, they'll have a discussion. They may want some of us to come there and talk about it, but they're not going, it's not a policy that's ready for them under any conditions. They're going to assign one of their staff to come up with a policy document that they will then vote on. And so this isn't going to be, this is a set of policy recommendations. It is not a policy. And so we'll have another opportunity to see how they may go like, oh, hell no, we're not going to do any of this. Or they may say, this is pretty good. Let's have the city manager send somebody to put this in language that we can all do. And then it has to go through the whole public process about doing that. And so I think that we ought to begin it tonight with what we're just kind of coming up with.
And I would say that that's correct in the sense that Rich, like you may recommend that the city needs to identify some funding and provide funding for or some staff people, but you wouldn't necessarily say where that funding is going to be coming from. I mean, right. That's up to them to decide. The other thing I was hoping you'd give me, or my thought, or like the feedback that I would like from you, is that the number four, the plan of coordinating groups inside and outside of the city, I see that as sort of an ongoing you know, work to continue to cultivate more resources, more volunteers, more spaces. And that part of that is about working with other entities who have publicly owned buildings, like the school district. So we heard that multiple times, like the school district needs to provide some space, especially for those daytime shelters and SOU and the libraries. But really at this point, like we don't have any commitment from any of those players that they would be willing to do that. And so I think this is where the number four, that sort of ongoing work, it should also be part of the dedicated policy, and that it should be ongoing and regular.
Excellent. I totally agree.
I think that part of our work as the Housing and Human Services Commission should be to try to bring some of those entities together. Part of how this all started was we were ordered by the then mayor to meet and try to figure out what to do about the homeless situation in Ashland. So we morphed into this commission. And so I would see it as something that we could take on.
So I will write it in that the Housing and Human Services Commission will hold that number four piece. How does that feel to you guys?
Okay. So this part.
Yeah.
I don't know that I think that's the best way to do it. I'm feeling like it should have some connection with the city, the city manager and then the group, someone below the city manager and then the group of stakeholders that are meeting. I'm not so sure that we'll be able to react as quickly as is going to be needed.
Well, we have the DMAT. That's what the DMAT does.
yeah, right.
And then, but I think Linda's point and everybody's point is that or Heidi's point is that as a commission, we're going to have a role.
Yeah.
And I think we want to, and, you know, it may evolve, but for now, I think we're going to be playing a role in how this rolls out, so to speak.
I don't think we're going to get the school district to show up at our housing and human services meetings would be one example of, you know, or the library to send a representative. I don't think that's going to happen.
The library has a social worker that's supposed to be doing stuff like this.
Well, as I was on the school board and I was ordered to be part of that original ad hoc committee to represent the school district.
That's awesome.
How I got involved in all this.
Oh, that's great, Heidi. That's great.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah,
you know, that's great.
You know, the one thing that I would say is that we're with this. This is a kind of a big step up for everybody. And it's asking the city, not just the city council and the city administrator, but the whole city is going to have to start playing a bigger role in where we're going. And, you know, I don't know how otherwise to say it, but I think we have an opportunity to do a big thing if we get this adopted. And I'm not sure that it will be, but I think we have an opportunity to see a big step forward if we're there.
Yep. And that's under number six. I just highlighted it.
Well, back when all this started, the mayor convened the ad hoc committee. So we might say this: the mayor, in conjunction with the city manager, will coordinate a subcommittee or that involves all the stakeholders, something like that.
Yeah.
Throw it in. Because we're getting 10 minutes till, I'm hoping that we've had enough discussion that there's a consensus that we can move forward with this new document that Linda's going to present or develop with us. It's not new. It's right in front of us in some ways with the suggestions that we've done to improve it. And if we have that consensus, then we can have Linda send us out that final draft, and we'll each have individually a chance to put a different point on it, but that in the end of the day, that Linda will have that ready to go as a response to the city council and through whatever channels we need to do that. Does that sound all right?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. So then if that's the case, I unfortunately would think, Linda, can we skip over the affordable housing presentation? Is that okay?
Yes.
Need to do we this again.
We get back to it whenever it's always around.
Okay.
One thing I just wanted to say is that, you know, when this does go to the council with your recommendations, all this narrative that's in here, or a lot of this narrative and the process pieces and all the meetings you had and all the stakeholders and all of that will go into the packet. So even though it'll be distilled down, you know, to some sort of basic pieces, they will get to see how you got there. So I don't know if you guys are, maybe that alleviates some of the feelings of uncomfortableness around feeling like it's coming together maybe a little
easier. Yeah. Linda, I'm actually working on a properly formatted bibliography of all of this background stuff that we did, because, you know, it's what I did for a living, was doing stuff like that. So I pulled together all this stuff, sort of background reading that Rich and Joy and I did. And it will look like a professional kind of bibliography of source material.
Nice.
And if people want to walk out and read some of that stuff, awesome. Or if they just want to know that one exists, that's great too.
So yes, I really appreciate that. And we can include that. That would be great. And for your edification, if you ever read any housing documents on the city's website and you see that it is riddled with footnotes, it's because I wrote it. And I never, I have to cite everything because I have a history degree. And that's
awesome.
I love people who appreciate footnotes.
Well, I would just say that I can hardly remember a time when our commission has had an opportunity to really roll out a whole new policy for the city. And I think everybody did a good job for it. And so hopefully the city council will appreciate that same work. And then we can get on to some other ones too. Linda Rapon.
Could we not share screen just so I can
see? Yeah, I was just going to turn it off.
Thank you.
Here we go.
Do we need a motion? Because we're going to continue this completion by email, but do we need to make any decision here tonight to forward that, to make move that forward?
You know, I did it by consensus, but it may not be that consensus is the way that the city wants to understand it. So perhaps a motion to support the policy recommendations that will be drafted by Linda over the next week. Or does somebody want to come up with a motion and second it?
What are you thinking, Linda?
Well, I mean, I think it can be done either way. You could make a motion now saying, you know, I move to approve the recommendations with the corrections discussed, which I will then mail out to you. And then we could also do it via email, in which case when we have that finished document, then we could do a motion that I would email out to you all. It might be cleaner to do it in,
Okay.
I don't know that there will be, I mean, I feel like I got good direction from you, and it will only be if I email out, you know, what I put together based on the direction you gave me tonight. And then we get, you know, some significant changes then I would feel more comfortable with an emailed motion because that might be a substantially different document and I want to make sure that it's reflected in the motion. If you guys feel like what we've talked about tonight really does cover most of what you're feeling and that there probably won't be any big corrections, then I would just do it now because it's in this, you know, really transparent venue. Whereas the email thing is also theoretically transparent, right? Because you're just emailing me, but it's not as transparent, right? Because it's not here. Mm-hmm. That didn't answer your question. It just didn't.
No, I would feel more comfortable seeing a document before I vote.
Okay.
So my understanding is that I am noting in the minutes that you discussed certain topics and Linda is drafting a policy that she will email to everyone and you guys will recommend, have a recommendation motion over email.
That sounds good.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Kathy Kelly, you've been quiet. You got questions? You want to throw anything in as we move to the next piece?
Well, I'm excited to hook up with Echo to really review the capacity analysis. That'll be good. Okay. Thank you, Echo, for being my mentor, and Linda Rapon too. And yeah, because my full-time job right now is working with fire survivors, I'm very interested in interviewing the fire survivors in the 70 home park that burned on the north end of town, which actually happened to be my neighborhood. So in terms of, you know, that presentation in the beginning and the, you know, I'm my brain is fried. I'm sorry, guys. I work full time on Zoom and it's like, this is the end of my work day. So I want to be part of that process to interview fire survivors from that park. And I know how to find them.
Yeah. That's good. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Linda Reed, technically that Bear Creek Park is outside the city limits. Mm-hmm. Is anybody in city council, et cetera, going to get picky about that?
No.
So like if we have stories from Kathy's neighbors from the Bear Creek Park, and it's in the stories in that housing production strategy process that Brandon discussed earlier, there's not going to be somebody saying, well, you can't include those stories because technically those people are outside the city limits.
No.
Okay, good.
I mean, you know, we have this discussion all the time because her address or that park's address is Ashland. Yes. So, you know, it is, and it's not actually, I mean, it is in the county, but their address is Ashland and the children who live there go to Ashland School. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot of that interface where, I mean, they're part of the Ashland community.
Okay.
The only time that demarcation comes in is with like planning and zoning stuff. Like we have no control in what happens outside of the city's boundaries. And the other time it comes up is when you use CDBG money, you can't use it outside of the urban growth boundary. So that's the only time those demarcations become a real issue. So it should not be an issue.
Thank you.
My long-winded answer.
Okay. I'm going to skip the liaison reports because it doesn't look like we need that. But the upcoming events and meetings do need a little note here. So we do have the Snowberry 2 preview. Have people gotten information about that for December 1, is it not?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I just wanted to highlight that one of the things that's very necessary in Ashland is to get public awareness of the work that's going on for affordable housing. And there's so many people that we talk to that have no clue about Snowberry, let alone Snowberry 2. And this is an opportunity, if we do it, to get more of that public information education out there. So I'm hoping that if you can, as a housing commissioner, can show up for that. Has everybody been through? Is there anybody that's not been through Snowberry? A few have not. Okay. So it's really, really cool for so many, for so many reasons. I just saw that families that got in there when I was at Head Start thrive so much.
Yeah.
it just went from extreme difficulty to way better. And so taking a look at what they do over there is cool.
It's so well built too. Yeah. It's built for families and beautiful wooden floors. And the families who got in, that we got to visit with when we went on the tour, they were so proud. Come in, let me show you. I want you to see. Look at the handles on the closets. I mean, that's how proud they were. It was fantastic.
How many of those units are going to be designated for fire survivors? Do you know? There's a number, isn't there?
I think it was 22 or 25 or something is what I heard. And then I think there are 6 units designated to families working with Maslow Project. And can we talk really briefly about an agenda for the retreat, the goal setting retreat? We're going to be meeting there. We do have a budget, so I'll talk to Gina about how we'll do food, and I'll email stuff out to you guys too. And then normally for the goal setting retreat, we have a chunk of time to do goal sticky stuff and throw it out there and brainstorm. And then we usually have an education piece as well. And earlier on in the year, we had talked about trying to get together to tour the new Aura Center. And there is time, or they have time on their schedule to give you all a tour from 1 o'clock to 2. So the meeting is from 11 to 2, and they can do a tour from 1 to 2. And that could probably serve as our education piece. And it would be good because the meeting is noticed. And so you can all be together and it's noticed, and that public meeting piece is met. And then I could probably also arrange for us to tour the Rogue Retreat facility after and have them talk to us about their process and what's going on. Do you guys have any interest in doing that as part of our goal setting retreat? Is that okay? So we're going to confirm with Aura, and then I will call Rogue Retreat and see if we can set that up. So it would probably be from like 2 to 2:30. So it kind of is taking much more of your day. And then at the beginning, we'll have lunch and or snacks or something, and then we'll just do the goal setting piece first, which is we usually do it the opposite way. But does that feel good to you guys?
And we're confirmed for the hotel?
Yes.
So didn't I see in the materials that we agreed to talk about food security at that retreat?
Right. That was a big topic because I think, you know, that we had that letter from Elizabeth at the last meeting that sort of talked about what is the future of Uncle Foods and how do we even need community meals anymore and how will that be structured? So normally the goal setting piece is that we have a discussion. Well, normally it would be we would have a topic of interest that we would learn more about. Then we would have a discussion and then people could go up and put the things that are their priorities on a board. And then you get your stickies and then you can put your stickies up while we do lunch. So what we might do is start with the discussion piece at the beginning and go right into brainstorming, have our food little breaky thing or put up your ideas through that brainstorming and then do the dot thing while we sort of snack and whatnot. Does that feel like a good process for you?
So the discussion part is about food security. Is that the only discussion?
It can be open. Because I think there are other topics that have fomented.
So Linda, will you provide us with the goals that we had last year so that we can talk about the progress we've made on those goals? I think that's an important part of the discussion. And then people can look for what's the extension of those goals or additional goals.
Great. Yes. And I also try to get a hold of the council goals, although the new council hasn't done a goal setting yet. And I don't. Yeah, I might just send you a link to what exists on the city's website already. You can look at it if you want. Okay. Thank you for that direction. That's all I needed.
Great. Well, amazing work, folks. I know we're all ready to sign off, but I know that we all just put a lot into that. And I think the result will be, we'll get a lot out of it. So thanks, everybody. And our next connection will be December 1st, if we can, and then the 9th for sure.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Linda.
December 1st tour?
What time is it?
What time 11. Is it?
11.
I don't. And we're meeting place?
Yeah, I have an email from Gina Duquesne, and I will send it out to the commission.
It's 11 a.m. 2261 Villard Street, which is off Clay.
Which we paid for with CDBG funds. Bye, everyone. Have a good night.
Bye. Bye. Bye.